You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I'm speaking with New York Times bestselling author, screenwriter, and mother of three, Kelly Oxford. For those of you who don't know, Kelly was a stay-at-home mom turned super successful writer, and I love both of her books, including Everything's Perfect When You're a Liar and When You Find Out the World is Against You and other funny memories about awful moments. Kelly is incredibly hilarious, truly insightful, and she's someone I've been a fan of for years. You are so many things. You are a mom, you are a writer, you are a not okay activist, you are the co-creator of Mean Tweets, you're one of my favorite people to follow on social media, period. And I feel really incredibly lucky to have you with us today.
Thank you.
So thank you for coming on Second Life.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So one of the things that I really love about your story is the fact that you went from being a super young stay-at-home mom to being your family's primary breadwinner and having this like crazy cool career writing best-selling books, writing for TV, writing for film, and you're still very young. So first of all, color me impressed.
But
I want to go back to the beginning, like before you became this wild, outrageous success. I want to go back.
Right.
Back to Canada.
Back to where it began.
Yeah, back to you. Let's get your origin story. So before you became a New York Times bestselling author, and you were raising three kids.
Yeah.
What was that like? What was the plan?
There was a plan to have kids. There wasn't a plan to have a career. I always wrote and, I'd been writing since I was a little kid. I was just a reader and a writer and, you know, as I got older, as I think most readers do, I sort of switched to film, you know, and I worked in a video store and I took screenwriting classes. And I just loved to write. But because I was Canadian, I knew that there were a lot of obstacles to get into the business because I was an American. Getting a visa, getting a green card, all of those things were just foreign to an 18, 19-year-old.
And seems insurmountable. It's not like there's
Absolutely.
A class that you can sign up for that says, like, hey, here's how to get a green card.
Yeah, exactly. And I would fly down to L.A. and party, I guess, when I was a teenager a lot and try and figure it out. And I would meet, you know, actors and writers, and I would say, you know, how did you get your job and how did you do this? And everybody sort of said the same thing, that they were, you know, a writer's assistant and worked their way up. And I just thought, there's no way I can do this because I'm going to have to work under the table and I'm never going to be able to do this, and that's what I want to do. And, you know, then I met my now ex-husband, and we fell in love, and he wanted to start a family, and I was like working in coffee shops and writing and working in bakeries and writing, working in shoe stores and writing and putting stuff online. And, you know, I think it was just after having kids, I saw the world again through a new set of eyes and through new comedy. So my writing took another turn, and I was really writing through the eyes of my kids and their jokes and those sorts of things, and writing online, and it became very popular online.
How did you know that it was becoming popular online?
I think it was, I mean, it was really like, early on in the internet. Like,
you had a blog, right?
Yeah, I had a blog. I've been writing and posting things online since 95. So I'm like an internet pioneer.
OG.
Yeah. Like, I was really surprised it took so long for everybody to get on the internet. I was one of those people that was like, what's your email? And they're like, I don't have the internet. Because to me, it was the greatest, and it still is. Obviously, everybody knows it now. But to me then, it was the greatest invention of all time because it was the telephone and it was your television and it was everything wrapped into one.
And it was also, if you were isolated, a way of connecting you to the world from wherever you were.
Yeah, exactly. And I used it. I really used it because I could. And I knew that it was like a big magazine, a big newspaper, a television, you know, like, what am I trying to say here? Like a cable station. Like it was everything, you know, and I could post my own material there and people would find it. And I knew that I was becoming popular when I had a blog and there were 7,000 subscribers and it was 2002.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. It was really early and there were 7,000 and I thought, this is really big because I would go to other people's blogs and they weren't, you know, they would have like 100 or 200 and I was like, wow, I've got seven. That's a lot of people. And this was...
Were you promoting it at all?
No.
Because I was going to say that's like MySpace days.
Yeah, it was
basically.
Like right before MySpace. It was like around the exact same time that MySpace started. And when MySpace started, I thought, this is great. Everybody's going to get online. And then when Facebook came out, I was like, well, now everybody's going to be online. And, and I need to start using my name instead of a moniker. And
what was it?
I'm not going to say because I don't. Because I think there's still stuff out there that I haven't been able to go through and pull because I don't remember passwords anymore.
Got it.
And because I was anonymous then, I would write more.
Candidly?
Yeah.
Okay, so you also, I think the one thing that's also important to realize is that when we say blogging now, people tend to think of it as like fashion blogging and like outfits and all this. But back in the day, and I remember this very vividly, it was like LiveJournal. It was like, it was a place of words.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I would write essays almost every day or short scripts.
What was your posting cadence?
Yeah,
did you have like an editorial calendar?
No, I would shift between either pictures and captions. So Instagram. Mm-hmm. I invented Instagram on my blog. It was either I would rotate between the three. It would be a short essay, like, you know, between 200 or 400 words. It would be like a short script of a conversation or multiple conversations I'd had with my kids that day, or it would be the Instagram-y post with pictures and captions.
So as someone who has a baby right now,
yeah.
I am really tired, like bone-crushingly tired. You had three kids and were doing this. Where did that drive come from?
Just my sanity, because I wasn't going out and seeing people, and this was my way to connect with the world. And also, I mean, I just find that if you don't have comedy in your life, for me, I'm a dead person. Like, I need comedy
or death.
I'm comedy or death. Like, I would, it wasn't
that's
that
a good tattoo. I'm kidding. That's a terrible tattoo.
I'm going to get a huge tattoo across my chest that says that, and I will blame you. But I didn't like doing all of that kid stuff. Like, I didn't love going to the park, and I didn't love – I mean, I like going to the zoo because we had a great zoo in Calgary. It's a beautiful zoo. If you ever go to Calgary, definitely go to that zoo. But I did it for material, really, you know. And, of course, I'm going to take my kids out and entertain them, but it made it much more exciting for me to know that I was – getting material by taking them out into the world.
You were doing it for the gram.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Before the gram.
Before the gram. That's really interesting. Okay, so you're blogging, you're writing, you're still writing screenplays?
Yes.
And this is all going on sort of like a simmer in the background while you're also like raising three kids, which I would imagine takes, you know, a fair amount
of
time.
Yeah. Yeah. When I wrote... I wrote – the first thing that I wrote that I sold – well, maybe I should say, like, how I got
– Please.
– an agent.
Yeah.
Was – I mean,
tell me that part.
It was from Twitter. It was from Twitter. I became really popular on Twitter.
What era is this year-wise?
Between 2000 – no, it was 2010. I really picked up – 2011, I got an email from an agent, a WME – who wanted to meet with me
Based on your tweets?
Based on my tweets and things he had heard from other writers. Particularly Jill Soloway wrote a piece about me in the Daily Beast and told him about me. I'd become friends. You follow Joni Marchenko. I'd become friends with Joni Marchenko on Twitter, and we became friends over the phone. And she thought my life was so funny and encouraged me to write a pilot. So I wrote a pilot, and she helped me out with that.
So an original pilot or like a spec
pilot about
script?
Like a spec. It was a spec, mm-hmm. original. And I wrote it about the kids in my life in Canada. And, you know, when I was done with it, I turned it into WME, and they were like, we think we can sell this. And I was just like, really? I wasn't really sure what to make of it because I was still at home with a baby, changing diapers and like.
And this is like your side hustle.
Yeah. It wasn't even like I was trying to get anything, which is so interesting.
You were doing it for you?
I was doing it for me. I mean, I was tweeting for me. I wasn't trying to. I mean, my husband had a great job. I was like living that housewife life. and it just sort of weirdly happened. And then Jessica Alba DM'd me it was on Twitter. And she said that she really liked, she had read some of the things I'd written on Tumblr and my tweets. And she said that, you know, as a mom herself, a new mom, because our daughters are the same age, our youngest, my youngest, her oldest, that she really related to my voice, and she hadn't read any scripts or anything by anybody that sounded like her and could relate to her. And she said she would support me in any way. So I brought her on board with the script that I had written with the help of Joni. And I flew out to L.A. to pitch the script, which was insane. With Jess.
You leave diapers.
I leave in Canada. In Canada for like 3 days.
To go stay with Jessica Alba and pitch a show. I mean,
yeah.
That's got to be like a crazy pinch me moment.
Yeah. It was, I mean, it was like.
Or were you NBD?
Well, I think I was a little bit NBD because my life was so overwhelming, having three kids and being so busy all the time, that I was just like, oh, just got to go. I've just got to go and do this thing.
Multitask.
Yeah. I just got to go do this thing.
And it was just a scheduling issue for you.
Exactly. As long as, you know, the husband can look after the kids, it was going to be all right. And of course he did.
So you go.
So I go and I remember, like, and Jess is just so warm and nice, and I'm one of those people that gets instantly comfortable with people, like, to a fault, you know, where I'm just like, oh yeah, we've known each other for years, like a stranger. I'll go live with you if you smile at me, you know what I mean? My U-Haul's there, everything's ready to go. I'm unpacking my stuff. And that happened with Jess. Like, I showed up at her house and I felt like I'd been, I'm like, yep, this is my room. Okay, let's get up in the morning and go pitch this thing. And we did, and I was nervous, like I needed.
So those were your first pitches, yeah?
Yeah, that first script. And it was my first pitch, and it was luckily really easy because it was a spec script, so it was already written. So I just had to sort of go through what it was about with Jess, and it made it easier that she was in the room with me and we could riff back and forth. But we sold it, I think, the second day. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah, like, were you nervous?
I was so nervous going into the meetings. I was so nervous. And there was one meeting I remember at ABC, and 27 people came in the room to hear us. And I counted. It was 27. And I didn't realize it was because obviously Jessica was coming, so they wanted to be in the room. But I was like, is this what happens every time people go pitch? And now I know it doesn't. But 27 people came in, and I was just this mom is taking a break from changing diapers and pitching the show.
So you sold it.
We sold it to CBS. It didn't end up going, which was fine because I had already moved on and had another pilot deal and had started writing my first feature, which I wrote in like a month and sold to Warner Brothers.
Jesus.
I know.
So
it just happened. It just happened really fast, and then we decided to move to LA.
So how long was it from that first sale to deciding to move to LA?
I have about a year.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So how did you get to that decision?
I think a lot of it was that I was being called down to LA a lot, and I was leaving a lot, and I didn't want you know, my husband to have to work full time and look after the kids. And I didn't like leaving the kids very much to come down here for a week at a time. And the weather's so great here. It was a temporary decision at first. We were going to Airbnb from, you know, the summer until winter and then pull the kids out of school at winter break and re-register them in Canada. And it just ended up that we stayed longer because it was fun and I was working. And all of our friends were now here. So
you had a whole life here.
Yeah. And the kids loved it. They loved their schools. So except B. B dropped out of preschool.
Well.
But that's B.
But, you know, she's doing okay now.
Yeah, she's fine. She's fine. She's still not in school. Can you imagine? She's 9 years old. She still hasn't gone to school.
So what was the scariest part of moving to L.A.?
I think it was just organizing. And it's still hard for me to understand the healthcare system here. And
or lack thereof?
Yeah, exactly. I don't understand health insurance. I don't understand any of these things. And I feel like such an idiot every time I have to call and I'm like, what do I owe? Why do I owe? I don't understand any of it. So that sort of stuff has been the most difficult for me. But that's really about it.
But hey, it's hard for Americans, I'm just saying.
Right.
So
well, that's what I always
alone.
Think. I'm like, I'm not a stupid person, so I should be okay. I should be fine. Like this, I'm sure nobody else understands this shit either. Like, I don't understand it. But I made sure before we moved down here that I had really good, you know, healthcare coverage and I knew where the good schools were, so I had to move to the Valley and all of that stuff.
Did you have like milestones in your head that you needed to hit to stay continue? Or was there not
I
a huge
should
plan?
I should have, but I'm not one of those organized, you know, goal oriented people. And I don't know. It's just me. I'm just disorganized.
So how do you write in the day? So I know from following you on social media, from knowing you, I know that you have like you like to write from bed or, you know, there are times that like you have rituals where if you need to finish a script, you'll check into a hotel or do something like that.
Yeah.
But what are sort of like your go-to methods of like how do you figure out in the course of a day you have, you know, drop off, school drop off and pick up and this and that. And like how do you sit and write?
Yeah. I mean
what's your process like?
I have to do all the drop-offs. They go to three different schools in three different cities, three different parts of LA, which is crazy. So I do all the drop-offs. I'm usually home by either 9:30 or 10. And then I will see how I'm feeling, check in with myself, see what I feel like writing. I'll look at my desktop on the computer and look at all of the files that I have, all the different projects I have going, and sort of tune into what my emotional state is that day and figure out what story my mindset is best, you know,
suited for
and how where I could really pull some good stuff based on how I'm feeling. And then I sit down and I write. And I write really hard, and I'm very good at just really tuning in and writing for like 4 hours straight. We'll go by in like 20 minutes. It feels like 20 minutes. I'll be sitting there for 4 hours. I won't eat. I won't move. I'll just drink water. And then I basically pee and I go and I pick up the kids from school.
So do you think that – have you always written in like concentrated bursts like that? Is that how you are naturally or is it because you know that's all the time that you have?
No, I think it's just like that naturally. I need to finish things. I write scripts super – like I will not stop. I don't take I don't take a day break. I don't take a week break. I sit down. I wrote a feature the week before last in 4 days. And I just would write for like, I mean, my kids were at their dad's for the weekend and I wrote for the whole weekend and didn't do anything else. I just sat there and it made me a little crazy, but because of the story I was writing. But that's how I write best, is just really getting into the story and into that mindset of all of the characters and really living it and being present for the story. And I find if I stop, it's almost painful for me. Like I can't, it's almost OCD. Like I can't do anything else properly. Like if I had to go out and say, do this podcast, I couldn't do it because I was in the middle of that story.
And I mean, that's kind of amazing that the story speaks to you so clearly because I feel like so often people have to go through so many elaborate rituals to turn off all of the distractions to get them to sit down and focus. And like your natural state when you're writing is focus.
Yeah, it is. I really just have to get in the zone. And I'm not in the zone all the time. I'll go through, you know, weeks where I don't write because I'm not in the, zone. There's nothing talking to me. There's nothing.
Speaking of, like, do you feel like you're channeling something when you're writing?
Yeah, it's mostly just like my own emotion. And really, there's a lot of catharsis for it. And because I do write about myself and things that I've done, I find that's, you know, everybody always says write what you know. And that's just an obvious thing for a lot of people. Some people don't, and they're amazing writers and they come up with new worlds and, you know, things like I'm just not that kind of writer.
So no Harry Potter coming
from
me.
No Harry Potter coming from me. No, I've tried. I've tried to create these worlds and I'm like, no, I would rather write about the time I had a breakdown. You know, like it's just so much easier for me.
So what do you do when the muse, the internal, whatever it is, stops speaking to you? Do you ever get nervous?
No, I don't, just because I know that it's happened before and it's, you know,
it comes back.
It's not insurmountable. So, you know, I like to go for hikes. I hike a lot and, I find that really gets my brain turning. I do, like I said, you know, have all the files on my desktop with different ideas in them, and I'll just sit down and sort of sort through them and see what I want to feel. If I'm not feeling anything, like, do I want to feel like I'm in love today? Do I want to have an argument today? Do I want to, you know, spend some time with my kids today? And I'll go through all the different ideas that I have and see what fits.
How many projects are you working on at any given time?
At least five, I would say. But they're things that I put away until I can really get into them and just do them, like I said, you know. And there's old projects that I still go back to. There's a few features that are still in development, you know, just attaching directors and actors and that whole – I mean, I didn't realize. You know, when you watch the Oscars and they're like, this movie took 15 years to make. Mm-hmm. I always wondered how that was possible, and now I know how that's possible.
How is that possible?
There's just a lot of calls. There's a lot of calls, and, you know, a lawyer has to do something, and it might take them 2 weeks to connect with someone and sign a paper, and then it's another 2 weeks to get a call through to get a meeting, and then somebody has to read the script, and then, you know, like a manager has to read a script, and then they have to okay it. And then the actor has to read the script, and then they have to meet with you to talk about it. And then you have to go. It's just, it's never ending. It's really never ending. And it feels like, you know, my first film that I wrote was in 2012, and it's still in the process of being put together. And it's because, you know, it's not a Marvel movie, and it's not this big thing. It's a smaller movie. So those things, I think, are the ones that take the longest.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've also written books.
Yes.
Books that I own.
Oh, I love that.
That I went to Book Soup to buy.
Oh, thank you. Because
I'm old school.
Yeah, I love Book Soup so much.
Like an independent bookstore.
Yeah.
What do you say to women out there? Because so many of the women who listen to this podcast will have written me and said, like, oh, I'm a lawyer, but I really think that I want to be a writer, or I want to do this other thing, or I have a book inside me. What advice would you give someone who wants to write or thinks they have a book inside them but hasn't actually done it yet?
They just have to do it. I mean, really, that's all it takes with writing is just doing it.
Like sitting down and doing
sitting it. Sitting down and getting into the act of writing. I think it was much easier for me to write a book because I'd been writing online for so long and writing essays online for so long, and I knew what stories were too long for the blog, that those would be the stories that would go into the books. So the practice of writing every single day made it a lot easier to get to the books. But books are hard. Books are, I mean, you know, they're really, really hard. I did need to check into a hotel and get away from my life to sit down and really finish both of my books. But you just have to write.
I feel like there's something too. So when I first started, when Catherine and I first started the website, the first 4 or 5 years, I wrote every single story.
Yeah.
And writing our first couple of books was not a big deal because it's almost like being in the gym. Like I was in shape.
Yes, you knew.
And then by the time the third book came around, I was editing a lot more. I wasn't writing on a regular basis. Except for, I mean, like emails and tweets and Instagram captions. And yes, there are words being written, but not the real work of writing. And then when I sat down to write the third one, it was harder than the first two for a variety of reasons. But I think part of it is because I wasn't in shape.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, I was like, oh, I'm so good. And then all of these other things started flowing, but it took longer and I had to build in extra time because I felt like I was that montage of like the, you know, like out of shape kid, like starting at the gym, like working out. And there was some of that. So I think there's something to your point about like staying fluid and like just doing it, even even if the writing isn't necessarily great, just doing it so that you're getting things moving.
Yeah. And I think too, if you're going to write a book without, you know, pitching it out and getting a book deal first, it's great to figure out, you know, what's your theme going to be? Are you going to write, you know, are your chapters like going to be like mine where they're short stories? Are you going to write, you know, fiction? What are you going to write? And really outline it, because outlining is a lot of writing, and that
are you a big outliner?
That's a lot of work. Yeah, I'm a big outliner.
Do you do like a board with
note
cards?
I always wish I was a board person.
I always wonder if anyone actually does that, or if that's just something that you see in movies.
They do. I know a lot of writers that have the boards and have the index cards up. But for me, that's just more clutter that I don't need with three kids in the house. I can't do it.
So what's your outlining process like?
I honestly just open Word and just bullet point. I mean, the biggest thing for telling a story is that every step you take flows into the next moment. And, you know, the biggest thing for a screenplay is that every scene is an actual scene, sort of with a beginning and an ending, but it also builds on to the next scene or another story. So I think when I was an early writer, I definitely didn't know that. And I would love to just get a rant in there, you know, just like, this is funny, I'm going to write this, but it wouldn't move the story forward. So I think that that's sort of, you know, my best advice is when you're writing a story to make sure that every scene, you know, every time a character speaks, it can be interesting and it can be a rant, but it really has to build upon what the bigger picture is, or it's not going to be something that the listener or the reader is going to be engrossed in.
There's that idea of like you have to kill your darlings.
Yeah.
And I have the tendency that I will write something that I love and then invariably it gets cut.
Always.
And then I like that I have just folders and folders of like great lines that never have been
always
used.
Right. Yeah, you've got to kill them, or you've got to figure out a way to build something else on them, and then you can use them, which is what
do you
I try
do that?
And do. Yeah, I do that all the time. I've got so many notes in my phone and in little notebooks in my purses of things that I've thought where I'm like, oh, like almost like a tweet that I can't tweet because it's way too, it would be a subtweet for something. You know what I mean? And I keep all of those things. Like on the way driving here, I drove by a restaurant. I'm like, that's the restaurant he lied to me in. I'm like, this is what LA is going to turn into now that I'm single. Just driving by restaurants being like, that's the restaurant.
The right? scene of the crime.
The scene of the crime. Just little things like that I write down.
Like personal notes for yourself.
Little personal notes.
Little memos.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I really love about what you do is you write with such honesty, unflinching honesty about awful things and difficult things, but you also do it in this really funny and humorous way. So why do you think that that has resonated with people the way that it has?
I think that I don't know why it's resonated with people. Maybe because people are more like me than I realize. And I
that's kind of an encouraging thought, isn't it?
Yeah. I think people are more like me than I realize. I just find that, you know, in my real life, speaking one-on-one with people, I don't I'm not quite so much of an instigator. I listen to people more than my online persona might show. I'm more interested in learning about people than I am talking about myself. And online, I just sort of get to vent and say, you know, my truth or what I'm feeling or my opinion. It's all so one-sided. And it's nice to be able to get that part of me out online rather than in person when I'm with another human being that I want to get to know and spend time with. So I find that I sort of compartmentalize all of those things and use them online rather than being like that in real life. I find, you know, when I first moved here and started meeting people, they were like, oh, you're not at all like what I thought you were going to be because of your online persona. And I found that really interesting because then I learned a lot about myself that I really do that. I compartmentalize a lot of the things that I want to say and am angry about or find funny. And I do put them online. And when I'm with people in real life, I'm much more interested in having a connection than just being a loudmouth.
So I remember I was reading Twitter, I think, like legitimately when the not okay story happened.
You were on.
Yeah. I was like, Twitter is one of my favorite things because I feel like there was a moment when it was for writers and you know, word nerds, and then everyone joined and then everyone left. And so now it's just like news and writers. So it's back to what
I agree
I wanted from it. And I just remember seeing like it's starting to take off. What was that like for you?
It was completely overwhelming.
Was it? You have a hunch that you were tapping into something major?
No, I had no. When I tweeted the day that Donald Trump and Billy Bush, the tape came out, I was online, and when you know Donald Trump said he would grab he grabs the women by the pussy, I was reminded of a time when I was 12 years old and I was on a bus and a man did that to me and. And it made me so mad to see that tape, probably more angry than I've been in a really long time, even to this day. And so I tweeted, you know, my experience with what happened with me on the bus. And I asked other people to share their first assault. And I hashtagged it not okay. And within 3 days, there were over 30 million responses to it. It was crazy. It really roller coastered. And at the beginning of not okay after I tweeted it, I kept going and sharing more of my assault stories and, you know, just hoping that it would build. But it did so fast. And then I felt this incredibly overwhelming, awful sensation that I was the only one seeing these tweets because they were all coming
at
back
you.
To me. And who was going to see – who are these people, I mean, that were going to see this hashtag? I wasn't sure what I was going to do with all this information. So I started retweeting the people who were tweeting at me. And then I started getting the Trend Maps tweets back to me saying, you know, you're trending in Chicago, you're trending in New York, you're trending in London, you're trending in Sydney, Australia. Like it happened really, really quickly within an hour or so. And then I was completely overwhelmed just because of the content of all of these tweets. I mean, these were horrific things that I was reading and that were coming in. And I felt a sense of duty to read them because out of respect for these people who are all sharing and a lot of people sharing for the first time. So I really spent that because it was a Friday, I think. It was either a Thursday or a Friday, and I did spend that whole weekend until Monday. Honestly, like I went out once. I was in bed and I just was reading these tweets.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And at the risk of sounding crass, are moments like that moments that make you trust yourself more?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And make me feel, you know, less alone, you know.
Part of this larger human experience.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is.
What do your kids think about all of this? Is that a fair question?
People ask me that all the time. People,
to see your mom doing, like going from being not just your mom, but, you know, primarily a mom to now having this really incredible career.
We don't talk about it.
Because they're kids.
Because they're kids. And I don't want to be like, so what do you guys think about me? What do you guys think about my arc? What do you think? What was it? What is? What do you think?
How do you
I'm
feel
like?
About my art?
Yeah, exactly. That too. Like, what have you read my book? I want a book report. No, we don't talk about it. But I mean, they're aware of it being there. I do get stopped a lot. And when I'm with them, I think I'm more recognizable. I mean, it's just a part of their lives. They're kids. They're so self-involved and self-centered that they're not really interested in what I do too much. I mean, they're definitely proud of me and they like what I do because I have great stories for them and we do share those sorts of things. But we don't talk about my career, no.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if you will more as they get older.
Yeah.
I have to say, I was talking about you with my husband last night, and I was saying about how I now being a mom at 38 for the first time, like there is a part of me that realizes, it was like, I can kind of see how this is a young person's game.
Right.
Like, it's the lack of sleep. Kelly might have done this the right way.
Yeah.
You know, everyone, like, the lean in of it all is like, establish your career and then
have children.
And then go back to it because you're already established and you're going to like it more. It's like, no, I actually kind of see the benefit of doing it the way that you did it
as
well.
I mean, both ways have their advantages and disadvantages for sure. I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. I was 23 when I had Sal.
I mean, you were a baby yourself.
I was a little kid. It was fun. It was fun having a little buddy.
I can't imagine. It makes me sweat just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Like how irresponsible I was at 23.
Well, I'm still. I mean, now it's funny because I missed, you know, like all the dating in your 20s. And now I'm single again. And I'm just like, oh, my God, I'm stunted. Like I'm a 23-year-old in my head with all this dating. It's insane. Like, there's something wrong with me. I'm really bad at this. I'm consulting my friends constantly.
I think that happens no matter what.
I was married for 17 years, so I really don't know what I'm doing.
I don't think anyone ever knows what they're doing.
Thank you for saying that.
I truly, like, I think that's the moral of the
story. I feel like
all
my friends know what they're doing. They're just like, Kelly, don't do that. Kelly, definitely, yes, do that. Like, they all know, and I'm just like, okay,
It's that thing where you definitely can give great advice to someone else, but yet yourself, you have no idea what you're doing.
Right.
I think
that
it's
makes sense.
That.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, last question, and then I'll let you go so that you can go about your day.
I have to go let my dog in the house.
That's a good thing
to
do.
He just got dropped off.
Yeah. What are you working on now? And what are you excited
about? What am I working
on
now? I'm working on a couple things I can't actually talk about because there's no contract yet, but developing a couple of things for TV. I'm excited about putting together my old movies and getting them out there, you know? And I don't care that if it's going to take forever because I'm constantly writing new things and those will take forever as well.
So I was going to say you have some TV stuff in the works now, right?
Yeah, I'm waiting to find out if Hulu's going to make our show or not that I did with Seth Rogen.
Is this the 90s?
The 90s girls band show, yeah. You know, and if they don't make it, we'll take it somewhere else, and it's just going to be a long process. I'm trying to figure out if I'm going to write a third book or not. I mean, I'm going to definitely write a third book at some point, but I would like to write about being single.
You need more material then.
Yeah. I've only had a year. I need some more material. I need to break some more hearts.
There you go. And you say you're not goal-oriented.
You're right. I am goal-oriented. I'm the new Jackie Collins. Can you imagine?
I mean,
I kind of am. I'll tell you all of this stuff off air and you can tell me if it'll make a great book.
Okay. Done and done. Everyone, that was best-selling author Kelly Oxford. Make sure to check out her latest book, When You Find Out the World Is Against You and Other Funny Memories About Awful Moments. You can also follow her on Instagram and Twitter at Kelly Oxford. Thank you for listening to this episode of Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Kelly who have taken the leap to pursue their passions, visit mydomain.com. We want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so shoot us an email at secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram at Hillary Kerr. That's two L's in Hillary, two R's in Kerr. If you like the show, please be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and rate us and review us. Hopefully you'll say nice things. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by MyDomain.com.